So the title of the talk tonight is Feeding Our Freedom. And we come to a retreat with our huge biography of our life story. A million ups and downs and joys and pains and wounds and blessings and gifts, and every day 1 million thoughts. So how many thoughts in our life? And somehow this huge human being that each of us is, we kind of have to somehow pack it into breathing and sitting. So we're not at all trying to cut ourselves down into any simple box of called practice. But we do need to find wise ways, wise methods, wise directions of working with all this stuff. And it feels like we only see stormy waters, we only see waves on the ocean. We don't really see the ocean because the waves are so strong and so many and all the time. And we want the water to quieten down. We want to find stillness. We want to find a quiet pool. But the waves keep going. And when we find moments of quiet, what tends to happen is we see under the water, oh my God, so much mud and mess and plastic. And stuff floats to the surface that we didn't expect. We just, oh, a moment of stillness. Oh, wait a minute, oh my God. And it's quite hard for us to actually stay with the clear water, with the still water, because we're so used to stormy seas. Nevertheless, what we've been, I hope, practicing and certainly talking about is that is our basis, that is our raw material for liberation. Chomer Gelim in Hebrew. That is the material. And our closeness to it is where the freedom is. Famous line of Krishnamurti, the truth frees us, not the wish to be free. And so we really need not to be in illusion, but inside the stormy waters to find our freedom. Our needs, our issues, our stories, our wounds and scars, our joys and pains. That is the human situation. From there we start. Not to be under illusion of kind of Buddhist rainbows. So when we come here, our thoughts and feelings arise as soon as we sit down, and they can get pretty wild, and we feel often something is missing. And we even put, when we put this quite a lot into our practice, we feel I am not doing this enough. We've heard it so much in the groups. It needs to be different. It needs to be better. It needs to be quieter. It needs, I'm falling asleep all the time, or I'm disconnecting, or the practice not working for me, or it's not, there's not enough juice in my practice. There's many, something is missing. This is just life. We say that all our life is like something is missing. It should be different. Something should be other than it is. And every day, how many times in some way or other we say something should be different, I have to go and fix, change, improve, develop, etc. Something should be different from what it is. And it's dukkha, the first noble truth of the Buddha. He said it really clearly, like my old, I can almost call them buddies, the Rolling Stones. I can't get no satisfaction. The Buddha said something really similar. They're my buddies because I used to dance with them in the 60s when they were, like, before they made any records in South London. The shifting the view of what's missing is really important for us in this practice. Allowing dukkha, the Buddha said it's inevitable, pain will happen, suffering is optional. There will be pain, but we don't need to suffer. Suffering is optional. So how do we do that? We begin to understand that dukkha is a voice that we need to hear. Pain or difficulty, which can get very subtle, something missing in my practice, is just the same. Dukkha, first noble truth of the Buddha. It's voices that are calling, voices that we need to hear, voices that are coming in a way for us, not against us. A physical pain in the body, even biologically, is a call for attention. That's why the pain is there, is saying to the body, do something. Emotional pain is saying, pay attention, see me. Pain is a call. We usually shut down the call. We shut it down. We don't want to hear the call. So we disconnect the telephone. But the pain is saying, dukkha, it doesn't matter what, emotional pain, physical pain, spiritual pain, it's trying to get through to us and saying something is out of balance or something here needs attention. So because of that, it's quite important in our practice, and we have to give it interest. It's the voice of uncontrollable life. We want to control. We want to survive. We want things to be okay tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And life comes with other plans, like corona, or restlessness, or I should be sitting here like a Buddha and I keep falling asleep. It's just uncontrollable life. And it may not have, there may be nothing, a reason, it may just arrive. So we've been talking about the hindrances, and which is a kind of English translation of a Buddhist word. And Hebrew, michsholim, or whatever. I don't think that any of those words really are right. I think the best way to describe them is opportunities. They point us in the direction. They are invitations of where we need to look in order to transform and develop. And so our tiredness, it seems like an impossible problem. I sit here and after 2 minutes I'm falling asleep. But it isn't. It's telling us, pay attention. This is what the mind does when we don't need it. This is what the mind does when we meditate. This is what the mind is telling us. I'm getting out of here, says the mind. For all kinds of reasons. The mind says, I'm off. Sorry. Boom. Why does the mind do that? Well, Where does that come from? What's being switched off? Here we are minding our own business, totally peaceful and okay, and along comes an unreasonable desire for something to be different, for the whatever, the, something. Where does that come from? Leave me alone. No. I won't leave you alone. Or some stupid aversion. Someone next to us is breathing. So these are invitations, and they are where the practice is. And again, the practice is not about going to kind of celestial, heavenly realms, kingdoms. It's not about universal oneness. It's not about abstract ideas of bliss and perfection. It's this, which some people think, well, that's not a very kind of rosy spiritual practice. I want something much more sort of sweet and but I think it's the gift of the Buddhist way, which is, I was talking about it in one of my groups today, that if the central mantra of Jewish prayer is Shema Yisrael, right, and the emphasis is on Echad, on the one, on oneness, the Buddhist practice will come in and say, no, oneness is illusion. It's a word. It's in the mind. What you really need is Shema. That's what practice would say. Shema is the most important. Wake up. Listen. And then everything appears. Everything will happen. If you listen deeply enough, it will all appear. So, to understand how to work with the hindrances and work with issues and work with the dukkha, with pain, first of all, by the way, we have to understand that there is no end to dukkha, but it does get quieter and quieter as we practice. So the tradition says the hindrances are only finally gone when you're a Buddha. But they get much more minimal and minimal and minimal all the time. So our aversions get quieter and smaller and more. And our desires, okay, they come and they go. We have them, of course, but they get less dominant. Things get quieter, but they're still there. So they can get quite subtle, and if we've been practicing a long time, they get subtle, but they will be there. And thankfully they will be there, because they're the invitations. They say to us, this is where you need to look. Like the map of Treasure Island, and there's a cross on it, and it says, dig here, here's the treasure. So when something comes up like these hindrances, these phenomena, it's saying, dig here. Here's where the treasure is. Why? Because it's the voice of conditioned life. It's the voices of ordinary life that are kind of written in to the system, to the body, to the subconscious, to the unconscious. They're kind of engraved in the brain and in the body and in the heart, our experiences. It's it's like a kind of text, ancient text engraved in stone. So when we meet it, we meet our exactly, we meet and transform our conditioning. We meet the conditioning, but we can't meet it if we don't pay attention, if we don't listen to it, if we don't notice it, if it comes in the form of desire, because we want something different. We want to be like that. We want things like that. Or we don't want things like that. It comes in those forms. Dukkha can come in the form, of course, of thoughts and of body pains and of loops in the mind. But the hindrances are quite interesting because they're on the side of the engraving in the boundaries of body-mind, the boundary of subconscious and conscious, like restlessness, you could say, agitation. It's not a thing, it's not a kind of a clear pain like my knee's hurting. But it's coming from that place, and if we dive into it, it will open and show us our conditioning and give us a chance to let it go, to clean it. So the first thing to do is allow. Allow the hindrances, allow the dukkha, allow it. Not shut it down, not try and say that it should be different. Allow it. It's a message. It's our teacher. There is the famous poem of Rumi that more or less every retreat in the whole Western world has been using this poem for the last 20 years, which is the guest house, you all know it, which is basically, it's very, very useful. It's saying the experiences are visitors that come knocking at the door and we need to allow them. But what's not usually quoted is lower down on the page, where Rumi says that these visitors that come knocking, that maybe we don't want because they kind of come in there and they upset all the furniture, they are messengers from beyond. And that's something important. Messengers from beyond, they tell us where to go. They tell us, go here. This is the call you need to listen to. So, be clear that when things come up, the hindrances or others, it's our human story. It's our biography that is revealing itself as raw material for us to work with. Not a problem, but a message. A teacher. So what do we do with it? The first thing to understand is what gives us pain and what gives us suffering, actually, is attachment, is the second noble truth. So desire as a hindrance, there's no problem with, oh, time for lunch. There's no problem with that. There's no problem with, the stomach is saying, oh, time for lunch. Or, I want to rest. Or any other desire. Desire itself is biological, it's not a problem. But it's a problem when it turns into, we give fire, we begin to feed it, it begins to work through us. Where if it's lunch, I wonder what's for lunch. I wonder if it'll be like it was yesterday. I wonder what time is lunch? Maybe 10 minutes. I really like the lunches, and it's very funny because I remember I used to do a lot of retreats in Kalil, and we used to give lunch, and my wife used to cook. and it was like a big spread. And then in the circle at the end of the retreats, that's all they talked about. But what about my teaching? Didn't you? Desire tends to make more of itself. Desire tends to grow and develop. What are these guys, these oligarchs right now? Do they need billions and yachts costing $1 billion? What for what? I remember the head of Apple Computers one time. I mean, he's multi-billion. Yeah. He said, actually, I can still only eat one sandwich. I would notice that in the comment, in some article or interview. Actually, all I can eat is one sandwich. I can't eat 1 million sandwiches in one. It's a human being, can eat a sandwich, but he wants billions. We need, you know, more. It's a tragedy, of course. It goes crazy, this desire. Wars are being fought right now. People are suffering endlessly because of one person's desire for an idea of expanding or of this or of that. One of the big problems is that any of these movements, these motives, these needs, we identify with them, they become us. And we are them. They take us over. That's a very fundamental attachment. It's us. We can't see a difference between a desire and a me. And an obvious example is being a victim. So I have received wounds in the life, and I build from it a story called Me the Victim. And then anything can happen from that. And it's so much pain. We construct around attachment. We construct story. We construct a self. We construct a personality. We make a life. We build relationships. Our whole life is run by attachments. We're running all our life from birth to death because of I need this, I want this, ambition, need, I have to get there, I have to be successful, not whatever. So it's very, very powerful, the construction. So there's four attachments, classically. The first is called kama. It's senses, to what's coming in through the senses. Lunch. But of course, pain, we don't want to stop. The attachment, the model of attachment that is Eastern, that is in the Eastern tradition, is the model of the honey trap or the banana trap. How in the Himalayas, and I did, when I was hanging around in the Himalayas, I did ask people whether they really use it, Indians, and it's true, they do. Take a coconut, make a hole in it of the right size, you put in a banana, you attach it to a tree. When the monkey comes, the monkey grabs the banana, but he can't open his hand. He's attached to the banana. He can't let the banana go. So he can't get his hand out and he's caught. There's exactly the same in Winnie the Pooh, by the way. One of the Winnie the Pooh stories, he just got in there and he couldn't stop eating honey and then he couldn't get out. This is an example of attachment. attachment to anything, Netflix, attachment to something we can't stop, the senses, addictions. The second attachment is to views, obsessions, beliefs, projections, them, the other, my views. Hold on to them like hell. I believe this to be true. And it's very strong. It can be very strong. So that's the second attachment. Views, opinions, beliefs. You can imagine how powerful that is. The third is, that's ditti. The third is sila, which is attachment to the way you think things are right, the way to do things, religious beliefs, God, kind of morality or way of doing things of a society, of a group. It's attachment to systems, to right behavior. I was joking to someone yesterday, I think, that I grew up in a German Jewish family and a community in North London, and one of the slogans was "One does this." In other words, this is the right thing to do. That's what one does. And as a child, I think, what the hell? I don't agree with that. One does this means this is what one should do. And I was really, I was doing big time rebellion. But those words, that's what one does, just echo in my mind as a kind of control system, which was, wow. But that's systems. I remember attachments to gurus in India. One day, the founder of Transcendental Meditation, what's his name, Maharishi, turned up in Varanasi, where I was living a couple of years. And they made a big thing. The hall in the university took over. And he had all these guys. It was middle of summer. He had all these European guys dressed in black suits with ties. In the middle of summer, with no proper air conditioning. But they were setting up systems and recordings and microphones and this and that. The whole team with black suits. And then this little Indian guy came, Maharishi, and just basically spent half an hour giggling. More or less, that's all he did. Which is all recorded, you know. But at the back of the hall were all the sadhus who were naked and coming from the Ganga, and there were people I was hanging out with at that time, and I was with them, and not naked, but I was with them, and they were laughing. And I said, "Why are you laughing?" They said, "Well, he just didn't make it, the Maharishi, so he had to go to America and make millions because he couldn't make it here. It was too tough for him." So he beliefs and rituals. And the fourth attachment is the self. And that's a big time. Atta. Me, who I am, identity, what my needs are. Everyone is really special. Indeed, but, there it starts, the me, and mine. So, these attachments, They are hugely destructive. Wars start from that. Millions of people can get killed from one guy's attachment to a view or to me or to what I think or what it should be or what I want. Not just today, but you know, all through history. So how do we work with attachment? First thing, as I said, allow them. We don't want to deny them or pretend they don't exist. We do want, as Rumi said, to let them in the door. To open the door and say, okay, you're knocking at the door? I see you. Come on in. Have a cup of tea. Let me see who you are really. So allowing is the first thing. And then seeing who they really are. Looking at in straight in the eyes. Not so easy always, but we can do it. Even tiredness, we fall asleep, but there is a moment when we understand that this is the heaviness, the tiredness, the change in the consciousness that's happening. Be there, stay with it, allow it, be interested in it. What's the change in consciousness? What desire happens? What's being built? What am I doing with it? Where is it going? What's the consequence? What happens to me then? What story am I making? What a self am I making? What sort of person am I creating through this attachment? It's a lot is in there. What is really happening? Very basic. What is happening when attachment arises? To me, views, desires, needs, whatever. What's really happening? It's not easy. And it's perhaps why we need retreats for several days. We need to get into it. It's not so easy. For example, boredom. Oh, it's not happening for me. I'm bored. It's not really. Where's the juice? So easy not to see that as a visitor and not to see it as an attachment and to believe it totally and just be bored. So easy. And it needs concentration, clarity, and interest to see, wait a minute, it's also a visitor. Or it's not happening for me. My meditation isn't working. That's a visitor. It's very easy to believe these voices. Very, very easy. So we have to give them that respect. Where are our stories? Where do we hold them? Where do we build them? Brain, mind, heart, body, life, history, narratives. Where do we build? Where are our stories sitting? Engraved, you know, harut. Where are they sitting in us? So we do all this when, if we are more clear and more deep and looking under the surface, which we learn in one breath or one step or one thought or one touch. That's where we learn. We learn to direct our consciousness like a kind of laser, and then we can turn it to something that comes up like boredom, and it will see it's made of layers. And under boredom is a me, and under the me maybe is our history, and under the history is a childhood that I want to forget. Whatever. We'll see the layers. Under boredom may be views of self, views of other. And it just seems like, okay, I'm a bit bored. No. We go through it. We go with like a laser into every experience. and it unpacks itself, it unfolds. And when we do that, some amazing things happen. Firstly, we see that a story we believed in is just a story. And what a relief that can be. It's just a story. Oh, I thought it was true. It's a story. And when we see that, the whole investment in building a self out of these things, in building a world, in engraving our biography so fixed and our issues and our problems so fixed, the whole thing collapses. We see we don't need to invest anymore. Lashkia, we don't need, the investment has gone. It collapses. It's empty. It passes. And it's a beautiful insight. This is not attacking our attachments, not trying to fight them, but just simply not feeding them anymore, not investing in them anymore. And that's an interesting word, feeding, and I used it in the title. And the reason is that in the Pali language, the word for attachment is feeding, what we feed. And that's much more dynamic than attachment. It means like something is closed, is tight, is stuck. But the word feeding is what we feed. It creates result. We feed this, we don't feed that. You know the story of the two wolves? And maybe it's a very traditional story from American Indians. A boy says to an old lady, a wise lady, that there's so much conflict and pain and suffering in the world. How do we deal with that? And the old lady says, well, it's like two wolves. One is a wolf of kindness and love and care, and the other is a wolf of harm and hurt and pain. And we simply don't feed the one of the wolf of hurt and conflict. We just feed the kind wolf, the right one. So we don't try and shoot the, because it's more of the same problem. We don't shoot the bad wolf, because then we're part of the problem. We just don't need to feed it. And so with us, in our practice, is quite like that. We just don't need to feed the attachment. So we want to get rid of it fast. Oh my God, I can't bear it anymore, this story that I'm telling myself. This loops in the mind, thoughts, disturbing thoughts, I want to get rid of you. So just shut up. And we really, but there is something more subtle than that, which is just don't invest in them. Allow them, let them arise. Let them come, let them go, and see that they're clouds in the sky. They're empty. They're not made of anything. And it's just not feeding them with our belief in them. Sometimes people ask me, you know, how do I give up addiction? Cigarettes or food or alcohol or Netflix or whatever. And there is the way, just fight. Or there is the way, what is that needs, that what's the hole that needs to be filled? Let's go there, to the hole that needs to be filled. And let's fill it with something. But not the addiction, something else. So it's kind of different, it's not attacking, it's kind of feeding. attachments are passing and disappearing and don't belong to us anyway because they're made of so many things. Just the Buddha said, they're made of conditions. Our experience, ourself, what happened, the senses, the whole, they put together and we build a story. If we look at that story, it's made of so many pieces. It's not a story anymore. It's a bunch of conditions that come together for one moment, make a story and disappear. Another bunch of conditions come together, make a story and gone. Who does that story belong to? Is it real? Is it solid? We give it solidity. We give it that solidity, but itself it doesn't have solidity, and that's why the truth frees us. And it's really an important insight. It's about non-control, but seeing things deeply. Not controlling, not trying to control what happens to us, not trying to fix everything, not trying to attack things, but just to see that they are made of conditions that arise and pass and not ours in the first place. They never were ours. We took them on by attachment, but they weren't really ours. So that's why they go. Because they never were ours. We owned them, but they never were ours in the first place. This story, this impression, this building up we made, this belief system, this thing I learned from others, what they say to me, it all comes from many conditions in the world, and then we own it. But we don't, if we look carefully, we don't need. There are clouds in the sky. So what's the sky? And what happens then? So something important in your practice, which is the hints of freedom, when we notice attachment and we can begin to work with it, whether it's hindrance or whether it's a pain that we look different or whether it's a story or whether it's thought or whether it's a feeling, doesn't matter. We begin to look at it. We see that it's dynamic and it's built of many things. It's coming and going. And every bit of non-attachment begins to open something else. So in my talk up to now, you may have a response. Well, I need my story. I need the desire for lunch. Otherwise, how do I make lunch? Okay. We're talking about what you do with it. But if that gets lighter, softer, less strong, and less dominant in our consciousness, what actually happens is something. It leaves space for something bigger. And that's the key to our practice. That when we are less controlled, something happens and there's space opens, and what happens then is other things come in which are bigger than the story. So when the story comes and goes, what opens? Something opens. A space opens up and other things happen. For example, anger. I've got it. My anger is neat. I need my anger, and I'm angry, and okay, fine. But what happens at the end of your anger? If you're able to see your anger as coming and going, and you're able to be with it, allow it. It's a visitor, yes, but it comes and it's gone. What happens when the anger has gone? What then? What opens instead of anger? And it's those places that are interesting. Notice moments of stillness where the waves on the water are quieter, just for a moment, because they're important. They're hints of what happens in the third noble truth. When the attachment is softer, is dissolving, what opens up is more stillness, is more quietness. What's the opposite of anger? When anger is gone, what's the space after anger? What's the space between two thoughts? What's the space when the heart is not invested in emotion and then is just quiet at the end? What's then? So give that interest. Everything comes and goes. When it goes, what? What's opening? We need to give a very, very big yes, like yes, to small moments of not being disturbed by thought, hindrance, difficulty, dukkha. Moments where, when the visitor knocks in the door, comes in and goes, Lehitra ot, bye-bye, thank you very much, shut the door again. So that moment is very special. Usually, we're quite busy thinking, what's the next visitor going to be like? what's going to happen now? But actually, what we need to do is say a big yes to this moment of, okay, between the visitors there is space. And even if it's short, it's precious. Because there is the hint of liberation. It's just about being very interested in the sky and not just the clouds. So we can't say, you must look at the sky all the time because we just see clouds. But if we're interested in the sky, it will gradually appear to us in this way, in another way. The Buddha said, bend your mind to liberation, meaning keep it in the background 24 hours. This is not a 5-minute business, it's not a 45-minute sitting. Keep that in your life. Interest in the space, interest in the sky behind the clouds, interest in something under, bigger than the story. Bigger than the me, bigger than what arises, bigger than dukkha and attachment. Nirvana itself, the awakening in the Pali and also in the Sanskrit, is not a drama. We sometimes think awakening is big drama, total awakening. Wow, it's not a drama. It's much more like space between things, space in the room. It's a stillness that comes because there's no waves, because there's no need for them. It's stillness which is not artificial because there's no need for disturbance. There's no need to be disturbed. There's no need for waves. And then stillness happens by itself. That's why the Buddha didn't really talk a lot about the path of awakening. He talked a lot about ending the suffering, and then awakening happens by itself. We know the image of the elephant in the room, right? So the story would be our elephant in the room. We want to see the elephant. It's usually we don't see it. We just avoid it all the time. We're not sure where it is, sitting in the subconscious mind. So we kind of walk around it, but we don't see it. But what's interesting is as soon as we see the elephant in the room, we also see the space around the elephant, which is not talked about so much. But first, to see the space around the elephant, we have to see the elephant. And we have to love the elephant. It's our biography. It's our story of our life. It's okay. Love the elephant. It's precious. But then love the room as well. So it goes very deep. It goes to universal. It goes to existence itself. It goes to existential places. We just keep going in this sense of what's engraved in the biography of the human being. We allow it, we love it, we allow it to be more dynamic, more free, more coming and going, more open, we work with it, and as we do that all the time, existence itself appears. We get more interested in existence and not in our story of existence, or our colours of it, or our wishes for it, or our needs about it, or our filters that we put on it. And so, final word, that awakening doesn't have any descriptions, it doesn't have any labels, it doesn't have any definitions, it's not something that can be known. It's much more in the world of the unknown, undescribable. But it's certainly the source of all of those labels, the source. It's a source, if you like, under the ground of all the labels and the thoughts and the views and the opinions. And so just love that place. Whatever it means to us. Thank you. Thank you. So we'll take a few minutes of quiet. So, time for walking practice under the sky. And at 9 o'clock there'll be a sitting with Simi.